Blog Talk Radio.
Swing and a fly ball, deep to left, down the line, could be, going, and it is gone for a home run for David Wright.
Struck him out swinging. Slider away. Tanaka tonight has struck out 10 and walked 1. I mean, that's pretty darn good, huh?
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to Gotham Baseball Live. I'm Charles Mark Healy, and it's time once again for what I think is the best time of the year, and that is the beginning of baseball season. The Super Bowl is over, thankfully. And, yeah, I say that because I had the Niners and the under, so the less said about that is the better. But we've got a great show on tap for you today, and it's been a long time since we have done the show, but we're bringing it back. Of course, now you might have heard that there's going to be a new book coming out called Gotham Baseball, New York's All-Time Team. It comes out on April 6th, 2020, which coincides with the 15th anniversary of Gotham Baseball. So I'm really excited about the release of the book. I'm really looking forward to it. Marty Appel, our good friend, baseball historian, best-selling author, and former Yankee PR director. Marty does the foreword. Award-winning graphic designer and artist Todd Radom designed the uniforms and designed the book cover. And our good buddies John Panisi did the illustrations, and Bill Menzel did the photos, along with a lot of great photos from the Baseball Hall of Fame. So really looking forward to the release of the book. And, you know, we'll be doing a lot more podcasts leading up to the book release, and letting you folks know about what kind of events we'll have coming up as the season unfolds. Got a really couple of exciting things in the works, so really looking forward to that. But that brings us to today's show, and I'm really looking forward to talking with John Cangelosi. You know, not only did he play for the New York Mets, he also played for the Chicago White Sox, Pittsburgh Pirates, and was on that 1997 Florida Marlins team that won an unlikely championship. So we're really excited. He's got a book that's been released. It's called The Improbable Baseball Journey of the Undersized Kid from Nowhere. And John has just been one of those guys that, if you know me, and if you follow my accounts, you know that, you know, John is one of those players that, you know, I just absolutely love. And we're very lucky that he's joining us now on the program. John, welcome to Gotham Baseball. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I really enjoyed reading the book because I remember, you know, before we get to all the other teams that you played for, I remember when you came on board with the Mets. And I was really kind of, because I had followed your career, and, you know, you're my kind of player, as you might have heard me say in the intro here, you know, just, you know, stealing bases, getting on base, playing really good defense. And that's kind of the thing that, you know, the New York Mets at that point in time in 1994, when you joined the club, it's kind of what they needed. And yet they had a guy sitting right there, you know, that could do all those things, and they just never, Dallas Green just never really, I guess, warmed up to you, and you talk about it in the book. But I just wanted you to know that I was one of more than a few Met fans that really wanted to see you play on a regular basis there.
I appreciate it. I you know, one, I'm for the fans that don't know, I was born in New York and lived in Brooklyn, and at the age of 5, my parents moved to Miami, but I love playing there. All my cousins and relatives still live in the area, and yeah, I don't know what it was, man. Dallas Green just it wasn't like we were in first place or anything. We were in a rebuilding stage, and when I played, I performed well, and for whatever reason, he didn't take a liking to me, and I was the number one guy off the bench. My numbers proved I was in like 270. I think I was in over 300 as a starter, and with minimal time playing. And then around All-Star break, right before the strike, he wanted to send me down. And I'm like, what's the purpose for it, Dallas? And he couldn't give me an answer. So I said, you know what? I that's when I asked for my release. And I think a week later, the strike hit. So unfortunately, I didn't get the playing time I wanted there. And I never complained about playing time. I knew my role with other teams, and I was happy to try to do the best I could, whatever role I was put in. But for whatever reason, that situation with the Mets, man, it hit a chord with me, because I was performing and playing well, and Dallas Green just did not like me for whatever reason.
Well, you know, Dallas, you know, God rest his soul, Dallas was like that with some players, you know, especially on that Mets team. And plus, you know, you had a guy at that time at AAA, you know, Bobby Valentine was there, and he was a John Cangelosi fan. So it's too bad that you weren't there a couple of years later when they finally fired Dallas and Bobby was the manager, you know, because
right.
Bobby loved you when you were with Texas.
Yeah, right. In 92, a funny story here. He kept me over. I was a non-roster player in 92, and Gary Pettis was guaranteed $1 million at the time, and they ate that contract and made room for me with the roster spot. And again, I knew my role. I was there for defense for Kevin Reimer. He couldn't catch a freaking cold in the outfield, so I was in like 80 games, and only had like 70 at bats because I would go in the seventh inning after his at bat and play defense, and I was pretty much just a defensive role for Bobby. And then one day I go in his office, I'm like, hey Bobby, I want to appreciate the opportunity. I know I'm a better player than what I'm showing offensively. I said, it's just really, really hard for me, you know, to be a utility player in the American League because, I mean, I'll have one at bat tonight and I won't have another one for 2 weeks. You know what I mean? I said, it's just really difficult. He goes, Candy, as long as I'm here, you're here. Don't even worry about it. You know what I mean? I got you for a reason. And 2 days later, they fired him.
Right. I read that in the book. That was a good chapter.
Yeah, two days later they fire him. I'm like, shit. And then I go to the park one day and Toby Air calls me in his office and he goes, Kanji, we're gonna reassign you. I'm like, nah. I said, I'm a 5-year player. I said, I appreciate it, but I'll go somewhere else, you know. So, and that's how that happened. But Bobby Valentine was a great man, great baseball guy.
Yeah, I share that opinion. I also share the birthplace of Brooklyn with you too. So, you know, when I was sent the book, I was excited. You know, I really wanted to read it because I was always, you know, when you're a player like yourself who, you know, probably should have gotten a lot more chances to play given the way. And it's funny, I think in the Moneyball era you would have been. You know,
right.
when you look at what you bring to the table as far as, you know, your on-base percentage was always consistently high during the course of your career. And you're right. You were a much better player in the National League because your ability, you know, great defense, great base running, on base, getting on base on a very regular clip. You'd be perfect for a lot of the teams right now in Major League. So I'm sorry that I'm bringing it up, but you know,
no,
they
no
always
worry.
Say timing is everything, you know, and you would have been a perfect player in the Moneyball era because of all the things that you did well.
Right. I mean, I can't remember the scout's name, but he pulled up a stat because they were in the winter meetings a couple of years ago and they were like, they were comparing, they said, who was the best leadoff hitter or blah, blah, blah. And they brought up Brett Butler. And the guy goes, you know what? He goes, yeah, he was an everyday player. He did this, he did that. But the guy that I'm thinking of right now, and they Googled my name or they did something, and they said, this guy could get on base anytime he wanted. And that was, they were referring to me, you know. And they pulled up a stat, and I know I'm going to butcher it, but I'm in the top 10 in on base percentage as far as with 2,000 at bats or more. I am like one of the highest on base percent or getting on base ratio in Major League history. So I'm in like the top 10 with 2,000 at bats or more. I know I'm butchering it, but that was the gist of the conversation.
That's okay. We're not statistically inclined here because I hate math, but I don't need a calculator to figure out just looking at your stat sheet and just looking at what you did. And plus, I saw you play. I mean, I saw you play the majority of your career. I mean, you know, you're a player that I always followed. There was something about you I always liked. I'm half Italian. You're Italian. You know, there was a lot of things about you. I played center field when I was a kid. I didn't have a tremendous amount of power, but I was a switch hitter. So I always followed players like you. So I was really excited got the book. And I was excited that you wrote it. Let's talk about that for a second.
Okay.
You know, what made you – What was your inspiration to write the book, and what was your reaction when, I mean, was it your idea? Did somebody approach you?
No. First of all, I want to, you know, thank KP for doing an outstanding job with the book. A friend of mine, I'm partners with Bo Jackson in a baseball facility. I'm an owner of a sports complex in Chicago right now. And one of my clients happened to be a friend of KP or something. And KP, when the guy was talking to KP about me, he goes, you know what, I like that story. Would John be willing to sit down with me on a few occasions so I could write a book about his story? And I was flattered. I'm like, of course, you know. So it wasn't my idea. It basically was through a third party, a mutual friend, brought my name up. And KP contacted me, and then the rest is history. We would sit down and over the phone about, you know, once or twice a week for a couple months, and he did a lot of history. He did all the legwork, so I really appreciate, and he did a great job with the book.
We're talking with John Cangelosi. The book is The Improbable Baseball Journey of the Undersized Kid from Nowhere. You know, it's funny. I always... You know, before I sit down and read a book, I remember when certain guys played, you know, and I think about their career, and I say to myself, what am I going to learn from this book, you know, that I didn't already know? And one of the things that was really interesting to me, and you may not want to talk about it, but I'm going to ask anyone because that's what I do because I'm irritating like that. But, you know, the whole Jim Fregosi episode in Chicago, where you went from being a guy that, you know, really was, you know, a favorite under La Russa to a guy, you know, and La Russa really gave you your first break. And then to have it, you know, turn so poorly with a guy like who's, you know, Jim, another, you know, baseball guy
Pies
that's left
on
us.
Pison, you go figure. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't understand, like, when I was reading it, I couldn't believe it. So can you share a little bit of the frustration about that?
First of all, you know, for the listeners out there, I'm a nice guy. I'm easy to get along with. I'm the furthest thing from being selfish. So, you know, I just didn't understand those two occasions, one with Fregosi and one with Dallas Green. But beside the point, when La Russa was there, I was an everyday player. Make a long story short, All-Star break. If Harold Baines wasn't on the team, I should have made the All-Star team that year. I was hitting .275. I lead the league in stolen bases and playing every day. So I had 41 bags at All-Star break, and I was leading Ricky Henderson, hitting .275, doing everything possible with the horseshit team. So Fregosi La Russa gets fired about 2 months into the season. And then after All-Star break, for whatever reason, you know, I went 1-for-12 or something in Oakland, hit the ball well, swung the bat early in the count a lot, whatever the case may be. He calls me in the office and he goes, I want you to swing this bat from now on and you're going to take a pitch. So he throws me this freaking U1. And for the people out there that don't know what a freaking U1 is, a U1 is pretty much like a Babe Ruth bat. It was just like a 35-35. The handle was bigger than the barrel. It was a bullshit bat, you know. And he goes, here, you hit with this bat, and you're taking a pitch from now on. And I'm like, so I'm 22 years old at the time, and I'm like, take a pitch? I said, Jim, I said, there's advanced scouts in the stands. If I take a pitch all the time, you're taking my bunting game away. I'm going to be 0-1, 1-1, 0-2 all the time. I said, this game's hard enough when you got three strikes, let alone two, you know. And he goes, get the fuck out of my office. I'm like, all right. So make a long story short, I go on a 1-for-20 something skid, man. It was brutal. I had no game left. So then I get to about 240. I'm just struggling, man. I'm upset. I'm struggling. And then we get George Foster in a trade, or the Mets released him. He's 45 years old at the time. I don't know what he was. So they recalled Darryl Boston. They put George Foster in left field, and they benched me. I'm like, are you kidding me right now? We're in sixth place, and you got a guy that's got 42 stolen bases, and you're gonna bench him. So 1 week goes by, 2-3 weeks go by, and then I go in his office, and I said, Jim, I said, I'm coming in here. I'm not complaining about playing time. I just want to know, what could I do to get back on the field? What do you want to see different? What could I do? And he basically ripped me into asshole, said, you can't play for me. The best you are is a fourth or fifth outfielder. And if the fans and Chicago people didn't like you, I would have sent you down to AAA a long time ago. So basically it was like an ego thing, you know, like, because everyone related to me on the south side of Chicago. You know, I was an underdog. You know, I went out. I did appearances. I treated people nice. And he didn't like that. I don't know if I was taking juice from him, or I don't know what the case was. So a month or two go by, I play, like, he gives a day off to Darryl Boston when you're facing Jack Morris, or freaking I'm facing guys that go 0-for-4 when they're playing every day. Those are the kind of at-bats I was getting, you know. So then there's about a month and a half left of the season, and Carlton Fisk comes up to me and goes, hey, Kanji, you know you got a chance to break a record that has been held since 1910. All you need is 7 stolen bases to the American League rookie stolen base record. I'm like, I ain't going in that freaking office to talk to the guy. He's an asshole. So I know for a fact that Carlton Fisk went in the office with about a month and a half left of the season to talk on my behalf and say, hey, let the kid play, man. He needs 7 stolen bases. Let the fucking kid play. And 1 week goes by, 2 weeks go by, 3, and then here I am, last 4 games going to Minnesota. This guy walks to the back of the plane, freaking sits next to me and goes, hey, man, I heard you got a chance to break the record. I'm going to let you play the last 4 games. I'm like, what an asshole, you know? So now I got to get 7 stolen bases in 4 games, and I haven't seen the field in about a month and a half. And mind you, you got Sutcliffe, Viola, and who was the other guy? The right-hander that became a closer. I mean, I had like 3. Oh, they could have been Cy Young guys. You know what I mean? So I'm facing these guys, and I got to get on base. So lo and behold, the first day I faced Viola, I think I got a base hit and walked a couple times. I stole, you know, 2 or 3 bags. Then was it Rick Aguilera or something?
Yeah,
that's
who it was. Mm-hmm.
So,
it was Aguilera.
Yeah, so I stole. I think I got 3 or 4. So basically, the last day I'm facing Sutcliffe. And, dude, I mean, he was so slow to the plate, I could stole 2 bases in 1 pitch. I mean, all I had to do was get on. You know, I mean, he was like 1-5 to the plate. So sure enough, the first inning, man, I got a base hit up the middle. Stole 2nd, and I got 7 bags in 4 games, and I got the rookie stolen base record. So, I mean, but getting to Jim Fregosi, I mean, he's the only one that I really verbally attacked in the papers when I got. So then it doesn't end there. So then, you know, the season's over, whatever. I go to spring training the next year, you know, knowing that I probably have to fight for a job or whatever, you know. So he calls me in his office and he goes, hey, man, it leaked that we're trying to trade you. So you just come, because back then there was no cell phones or anything. He goes, you just come to the park every day, and I can't afford for you getting hurt, so you're not going to dress out. So you come, and then if the trade doesn't happen, you just leave. So I really didn't even have a spring training in 87. So, when I got traded to Pittsburgh, I blasted him in the paper. I said, he's the most unprofessional coach I've ever played for. You know, his first meeting with us was, I don't have an open door policy to my players. He was just an arrogant asshole. And we went back and forth for like 2 or 3 years. you know, in the papers. He was bashing me. I was bashing him. And then one day I was in Philly, and I'm like, you know what? Enough of this crap. So I said, Jim, you got a minute? And we went in the tunnel, and I said, hey, man, I want to bury this shit. It's stupid. I said, I wish you nothing but the best. I got no hard feelings, man. And then he, you know, kudos to him. He goes, Kanji, I handled your whole situation wrong. I apologize. You know, you're a good kid. For whatever reason, it was, I can't explain why I treated you that way. And we made amends. So, I mean, let him rest in peace, too. But that was my Jim Fregosi story. Basically, he cost me a lot of money, too. I mean, I became a utility player after that because I got traded to Pittsburgh. And where am I going to play? Bobby Bonilla, Andy Van Slyke, and Barry Bonds. So I platooned with Barry the first year and became a really good utility player. And then the rest is history. But I'm not crying over spilled milk. But he cost me a lot of money because I could have been an everyday player. I probably would have ended up with 60-something stolen bases, and then that would have catapulted me being an everyday player another couple of years. And he kind of mind-fucked me, too, you know, from a mental standpoint. But, I mean, I was blessed with a great career, and, you know, I can't complain.
Well, obviously, you know, when I look at and I was, you know, it was furthering my aggravation was when you went to Houston in 95 and basically showed what you're capable of doing if you got a decent amount of at-bats. I mean, you had a great season in 95, you know, 318 average, 457 on base, played a great, you know, great outfield. And you played for a guy in Terry Collins that, you know, we all in New York certainly know very well. And it's funny, John, if you're ever in New York, you got to meet my dad because he's a dead ringer for Terry Collins. I mean, looks exactly like him. People stop him on the street and ask for autographs. It's unbelievable. But Terry was really good to you, and you responded by, you know, basically playing some of the best ball of your career in Houston.
Yeah, funny story about Terry Collins, and I closed that chapter. I circled around, and I got his phone number, and I called him, and I wanted to just close that door and just thank him for the opportunity. But when I was with Pittsburgh, he was a triple A manager in Buffalo, and I got sent down. Leland, he goes, hey, man, I'm going to send you to AAA for about a month. You need some at-bats and stuff, and I can't get them up here for you. So I'm like, all right. So I went to AAA for a month, and Terry Collins thought I was going to be an asshole, you know, like big league and whatever, but I was there, the first one there, last one to leave. I worked with his base runners. You know, I played hard. And then when I got recalled, he goes, Candy, if I'm ever in a position to help you out, he goes, I appreciate everything you did down here. So fast forward with the Dallas Green shit, I ask for my release. Terry Collins calls me the very next day. I'm in Chicago. And he goes, Candy, what happened? You're retiring or what's going on? What's your situation? I said, hey, man, I didn't appreciate what Dallas Green did to me, and I wasn't going to go to AAA for him because I didn't deserve to go to AAA. I still want to play. He goes, well, listen, if the strike doesn't hit, I'm gonna call you and get you a contract, and we'll get you over here. I said, all right. So I said, where's your AAA at? He goes, no, Kanji. He goes, I'm giving you a big league job. He goes, if there's no strike, I need a fourth or fifth outfielder on my club. I'm like, shit, all right. So then obviously we all know the strike hit, and there was no baseball in 94 or no World Series. So he called me. He goes, go to winter ball, stay in shape, come to spring training. And, again, make a long story short, there was really no spring training. It was replacement camp. So I had to go to that because I was under minor league contract. I refused to be a replacement player. They kept on us. I mean, it was a bullshit camp, man, what they did. So make a long story short, there was no really spring training for us. Then I go to AAA, and then big league start up again, and I'm in AAA. And then Phil Plantier gets hurt. Terry calls me up, and I'm there for about a week and a half, and he played me. And first game, I go 4-for-4 against Smokes. I go 3-for-3 against somebody else. I got like 5 stolen bases within a week and a half or 2 weeks. And Phil Plantier is still hurt. So now my family, I'm flying back and forth from Tucson. And then finally, like 3 weeks into it, I'm like, Terry, I said, I'm going crazy, man. I'm in a hotel. I got freaking 2 kids. I mean, it's nuts. He goes, what's his name? The general manager at the time, Watson. Watson goes, hey, Kanji can't get a place yet. He's not on the team, blah, blah, blah. It's just a temporary thing. So we're playing Frisco that night. I get a couple of hits. I'm hanging out with Barry Bonds. I'm like, B, man. I said, this freaking guy does not want to, like, give me a contract, man. And my family's flying back and forth. I mean, I got a hotel. I got an apartment in Tucson. And Barry goes, don't worry about it. The next day, he goes into Tom Watson's office during batting practice. He goes, dude, tell Kanji to get an apartment. He's on a goddamn team. He's hit freaking 380 last month. He's on the team. No shit. After batting practice, Watson called me and he goes, Kanji, go ahead, man. You can look for an apartment now. it was crazy. And then
that's
Harry
cool
Collins
that it was. It's cool that it was him too, because a lot of people have a lot of, I never had a good relationship, but a couple of times I covered him, so it's nice to see that, he stood up for a guy like you. That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
pretty cool story.
Dude, he was first class with me, man. Me and my family. He bought me a wedding present, bought me a motorcycle, and it's not the material thing. Barry is really misunderstood. What he did wrong was he got a bad reputation with the press. He treated the press like shit. I'm like, B, I said, you're on the top now, but you treat people like shit, man. And when you're not on the top, you're gonna fucking hear it. And that's what's exactly happening. He was a really good teammate, good friend. They don't understand, like, early on with his dad, like, and they rekindled their relationship, but his dad was really hard on him. But other than that, man, the guy played the game. He was the best player I've ever played with before steroids or whatever. He's a Hall of Famer, should be in the Hall of Fame. So, but he was a good guy. And then getting back to Terry Collins played me, and then funny, ironic. So I hit 320 that year. I think I stole 28 or 29 stolen bases. I was second in the league in on-base percentage. So I'm like, I got my stock back up. I'm like, yeah, man, now I'm a free agent. Okay, I'm gonna make some money now. At least get some security. Well, freaking, I become a ranked free agent, whatever that meant. So in other words, for me to go to another club as a free agent, they would have to give away their top draft pick, which I'm like, no one's gonna do that for me. You know what I mean? So it was me having a great year basically penalized me in the free agent market. So in other words, they were only offering me like $100,000 raise, the Astros were. And I'm like, come on, man. That's not even fair market value right now. I said, I'll take less money. Give me a 2-year deal and lock me in and I'll be good with it. Cause I was trying to get closer to 10 years, and they wouldn't do it. So I ended up signing at midnight. I signed a bullshit contract. And then I ended up playing that year with them. I did okay. I think I hit like 270. When I started, I hit really good. I think I had over a 300 average, and on base percentage was good. But for whatever reason, pinch hitting that year, I think I went 1-for-30. I'd either have a horseshit at bat or I would have a really good at bat and hit into bad luck and whatever. But I ended up having a decent year. And then that's when Leland called me. Jimmy Leland called me, and I was one of the first free agents signed when we won the World Series. Like, so he called me. He goes, Kanji, he goes, are you ready? I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, I'm going to sign you. You ready? I need, I'm doing my bench players first. You're my first guy, man. He goes, we're going to win the World Series this year. And he goes, just keep an eye on the TV, and we're not done with this. And then that's when we signed Alex Fernandez, Moise Alou, and the list goes on, and we ended up winning the World Series that year. So I signed a 1-year deal with them, and then I said, Skip, I said, go back to Dombrowski, do me a favor. I said, I'll take less money. Give me a 2-year deal, dude. And he called me back 10 minutes later, and he goes, all right, you got a 2-year deal. Unbelievable. So that was like first time I got a guaranteed contract, and I was like, I think I was 31 years old.
Well, but, look, the book is great. I hope you sell a whole lot of them. I put a link to the book on the podcast here so people can check it out. John Cangelosi, The Improbable Baseball Journey of the Undersized Kid from Nowhere. John, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
No, I appreciate you, and we'll be in touch, and we'll talk to you down the road. Okay, John?
All right. You take care of yourself, man. Good luck.
Take care. Again, that was John Cangelosi. Really just a great great interview, you know, raw, you know, down to earth, you know, basically told you like it is about his career in Major League Baseball. And, you know, a guy like him who, you know, basically, you know, had a great on-base percentage would be a very valuable guy right now. And there are a lot of players that have fit that bill, certainly, that wish they played during this time in Major League Baseball. This has been Gotham Baseball Live. I'm Mark Healy. Again, don't forget to buy the book, John Cangelosi, The Improbable Baseball Journey of the Undersized Kid from Nowhere. And we'll see you soon next time here on Gotham Baseball Live.